First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
After a marathon meeting, the Duval County School Board says all students in the district must now wear masks to school. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, we'll tell you why Duval has become the eighth Florida school district to defy the governor and require masks for kids. 549-2937 to join us. Then later, the skilled trades plan to see a big boom with the passage of the Senate infrastructure bill. We'll speak with Tulsa Welding School in Jacksonville. But first this morning, Duval County Public Schools has joined the growing list of school districts around the state defying Governor Ron DeSantis's ban on school face mask mandates. In a 5-2 vote last night, following 8 hours of public comment and deliberation, the board voted to require masks in schools, at school-sponsored events, and on district-provided transportation. The only way parents can opt out of this is if they get a medical certificate from a licensed pediatric physician, an MD or a DO, opting their child out for physical, medical, or psychological conditions. The new mask rule goes into effect September 7th and will last for at least 90 days. Joining us now, Daryl Willey, Vice Chair of the Duval County School Board. Hi, Daryl.
Hello, Melissa. How are you this morning?
I'm great. Thanks for being with us. And also on the line, Dr. Mobeen Rathore, Professor, Associate Chair, Department of Pediatrics at UF. He's also affiliated with Baptist Health and Wolfson Children's. Hi, Dr. Rathore.
Hi. Good morning, Melissa.
Already getting your calls as we talk about Duval County joining seven other school districts around the state and mandating masks for kids. Only a doctor's note can opt them out now. 549-2937. Give us a call. Emails to firstcoastconnect at wjct.org. Tweets to at Melissa Injax. Daryl Willey, let's begin with you. You are the current vice chair of the Duval County School Board. You joined with the majority last night in this vote. And it was you, in fact, who led the charge on this because you were looking at the spiraling case count in the Duval County school system. That worried you. So tell us more about your thinking that led to last night's vote.
Definitely. First, is recognizing our school board chairwoman, Elizabeth Anderson, for her great leadership as well. She couldn't be here on the call. But yeah, I mean, it was one of those situations where when you see the numbers, Dr. Green sent out an email to the full board on Friday afternoon just with some concern about the numbers that we showed, around 500 or so cases at that time in less than 10 days. And last year, about that same time in those 10 days, we saw about 20 cases. So it was very important that I felt that we had to get back together and discuss what our options were and what levers we can pull to keep our kids and our staff safe in our schools.
Now, again, this vote was 5-2. Charlotte Joyce and Lori Hershey were the only school board members to vote no. This rule goes into effect September 7th and lasts for at least 90 days. Why a 2-week delay? And what's your answer to those who are saying, we're glad you did this, but you should do it right now, not wait 2 more weeks?
Yeah, there was definitely a lot of conversation about that. And at the end of the day, the majority voted to give parents some room. If you did have a medical reason, you need to get that doctor's note, to give them room to do that, as well as making sure the staff and the schools were able to get ready for those mandates as well. So we wanted to give room to be able to do that.
Dr. Mobeen Rathore, you're one of a number of doctors who gave powerful testimony in the meeting about the risk to children. Can you talk more about why you and other pediatricians have gotten involved in this matter?
Well, Melissa, we all want to do, I'm sure everybody wants to do what's best for children. And the overwhelming scientific data and all of the major professional organizations, including the American Academy of Pediatrics that represents 67,000 pediatricians, believe that masking is an important and significant part of protecting our children when done in conjunction with other mitigating measures such as social distancing, good ventilation, good hand hygiene, good cough etiquette, good contact tracing and testing and isolation and quarantine when required. This is a significant part of protect our children. There is scientific data that to support this, and I think we need to be looking at science, evidence, and data when we are making decisions to protect everyone, but especially our children.
So what's your response to the people that spoke, Doctor, against the mandate yesterday and felt that it was an overreach?
Well, I respect everybody's opinion. I think one of the things we all need to do is have civil discourse. As I said in my statement to the school board yesterday, paraphrasing Senator, late Senator McCain, you know, those who have opposing views are not my enemies. We just have to look at things differently. I would say that when we look at science and data, so let me step back. You know, if my car breaks down, I'm going to take it to a mechanic, right? I'm not going to bring it to Melissa. If I need some journalistic
advice, that's a smart move because I could not help you.
All right, but if I need some journalistic advice, I'll talk to you. The same way, if you're looking at science and medicine, I think you need to, one needs to look at what the scientific community, what the medical community is saying, and what is the data they are presenting. You know, you can always find holes in any argument, and that's the whole purpose of debate, right? And I think, thank God that yesterday the leadership of Mr. Willie and the chairperson for the board, I think we reached a good decision based on science and data and evidence that will protect our children.
All of the districts around the state that have made this move are citing data, science, evidence. Duval County joins a long list of counties who are now requiring a medical reason to opt kids out of masks. The other counties are Sarasota, Hillsborough, Miami-Dade, Leon, Alachua, Broward, Palm Beach. You know, Darrell Willie, I'm going to play a little bit of an interview we did the other day. Of course, Governor Ron DeSantis said that he will seek to block the salaries of education officials who defy him on this. On Friday, on the Florida Roundup, we spoke with U.S. Secretary of Education Miguel Cardona. The feds have vowed to support local education officials such as yourself in this fight. Here's Cardona.
Our Office for Civil Rights is prepared to take on any investigation necessary to support the safe reentry into schools if allegations that students' rights to a free and appropriate public education are being violated. So those are very specific, concrete things that we can do at the Department of Education to support the students and families of Florida.
So, Darrell Willie, what about this? The federal government saying that if the governor docks your salary as a school board member or docks the salary of Superintendent Diana Green, they'll make up the difference and that their civil rights division will investigate any shenanigans that go on with getting in your way.
Yeah, we appreciate that support. But at the end of the day, even if they weren't going to step in and do that, I know for myself, the weight of keeping our kids safe is much heavier than that salary. So it didn't matter to me. Like, that wasn't even part of the conversation. I saw those case numbers, and Melissa, I have two kids in school myself, so I feel the same anxieties that other parents do when they get those emails that say, hey, we have a positive case. We're having to push this classroom to virtual learning. So that salary and that money, especially once it went to the salaries, my salary, I can take that. But at the end of the day, that pales in comparison to keeping our kids safe.
And what about the Department of Ed saying that they would use their civil rights division to investigate complaints that students aren't being kept safe? What are your thoughts about this, given that school districts didn't want to run afoul of the governor and the Secretary of Education in Florida, Richard Corcoran, but the weight of the evidence is so overwhelming? And now even the White House has your back. This is an extraordinary situation, Darrell.
Yeah, we are. I mean, we're at the epicenter in Florida and in Duval County for this. So number one is protecting our kids. And the politics of it all and the litigation and the civil rights pieces, that'll come. But at the end of the day, we were focused on making sure our kids were safe locally and putting every single measure in place. So not just the mask, but we talked about ventilation last night. We talked about our vaccines, Vacs of Kindness that we're pushing into schools. We talked about the daily sanitation that we're doing, similar to what the doctors are talking about. And there's so many reports out there going back and forth from Berlin, Sweden, and other places. But at the end of the day, it's about Baptist, U.S., and Mayo. And what are they telling us? And you hear Dr. Rathore today, and he's telling us, hey, this is going to help mitigate and not only keep our schools in a better place, but what happens in our schools affects our community. And I think it's really important that we both play our part.
Let's go to your calls now. Our guest right now, School Board Vice Chair Daryl Willey of the Duval County Public Schools and pediatrician Dr. Mobeen Rathore. Last night, after a long meeting, the Duval County School Board joined seven other districts around Florida in requiring masks for students. Parents can now only opt their child out with a doctor's note from a licensed pediatric physician. Lots of calls, 549-2937. Stephanie in San Marco. Hi, Stephanie. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa, and good morning, Vice Chairman Willey. First of all, I would like to thank you very much for calling the emergency meeting. And I want to say I have two children in Duval County Schools. One is a freshman in high school, and the other is a senior in high school. And I just want to publicly thank the five members of the school board who voted to do the right thing. To quote my daughter, there is no perfect solution for everybody, but we believe it's the school board's job to stand up and do the best thing for the most people. And what you've done is you've stepped up to protect our children. And for that, I'm very grateful. And I know being on the school board is a thankless job. So I just want to go on record as saying thank you very much.
Stephanie, thanks. Daryl Willey, okay. I'm sure you're hearing from a lot of parents right now, you and your colleagues on the school board.
Definitely. Hearing from a lot. And thank you to that caller. And your student seems brilliant. They're doing, Duval Schools is doing what we need to do, it seems. We're getting a lot of calls. A lot of folks who are thankful for the pressure that they were feeling at home is a little bit more alleviated. But on the other side, too, we recognize, just like Dr. Rathore said, that there's folks who don't have that same opinion. But we, as a board, we voted last night to make sure that we pushed the envelope as far as we could to make sure we're putting safety measures in place. So
you know, yeah.
Thanks to all the folks who are reaching out.
You know, Dr. Rathore, it's my understanding that about 10% of students in the district had stopped wearing masks. It sort of depended on where your child goes to school, whether you were seeing a lot of compliance. Let me disclose that we still have at my home one student in the Duval County Public Schools. Both our kids, luckily, were old enough to be vaccinated. Our youngest is a sophomore in high school. At her school, she says, virtually everyone's wearing the masks, but it depends on the school. So that added to your urgency, didn't it?
Yeah, and I think it's important that everybody understands that for this to work, everybody has to wear a mask. I mean, if only 10% of the people stop following traffic rules and don't stop at red lights, think what will happen. It's not very dissimilar. I mean, it's the same sort of thing. You know, masks protects the person who wears the mask, but also other people. And for this to work, everybody has to wear a mask. If 10% of 160,000 students are not wearing masks, that's a large number. So I think, you know, we cannot underestimate
16,000 kids. Yeah,
16,000 kids. And so, and you know, we forget that, as Vice Chair really said, that, you know, every time there is an exposure, we have to close the classroom, we have to test, we may have to close the school. I mean, how is that good for children if they are going to schools, coming back, stopping, going? I mean, that's not good for children. We all agree that in-person schooling is best for children. But in the same time, when we think that's best, we also believe that it's best for children to be masked so they can be protected and all the children can be protected. And by the way, the masking is, I think, is not just for students. The staff and the faculty also have to mask.
Mike in Jacksonville. Hi, Mike. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Melissa. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I also want to thank Member Willey and the majority for looking at the data, listening to the science, disregarding disinformation, and doing the right thing for our kids. So thank you for that. And I also want to lift up the work of groups that stood up to raise their voices in the community. Particularly the Northside Coalition of Jacksonville and the President Ben Frazier, who did a great job of organizing folks, bringing people together. I know lots of emails were sent out, lots of folks spoke up, and it was a great community effort. So thanks to those folks. They were involved with the Change the Names campaign. They're really on the move. So thanks to the board as well as the community and the Northside Coalition.
Thanks for that, Mike. Mary in Middleburg. Hi, Mary. How are you? Thanks for calling.
Good. How are you?
Okay.
The reason I'm calling is I'd like to know why Clay County isn't stepping up to having mask mandates, because the children are not 6 feet apart in school. They don't have protection around their desks. Most of the teachers are not wearing masks, and we don't know who's vaccinated and who's not. And I have a grandchild that I'm raising that's in a school, and I'm high risk, and I already had COVID for 45 days in November and December, and I don't need to get the new variant.
Thanks, Mary. You know, Dr. Rathor, Clay, St. John's County's masks are voluntary, and particularly for parents and loved ones of kids under the age of 12 who can't get vaccinated, they're very worried.
Yeah, I mean, that's very harmful to our children. You know, we have done mandate, and thanks to the school board's leadership in Duval County, but we are a region, you know, we move in and out. A lot of people live in St. John's and Clay County and come to Jacksonville. Today, we have 19 children in the hospital. You know, we have had more children in the hospital in July than ever before since this pandemic has started. And August is not looking any better. And I think we are going to unfortunately see kids from St. John's County. I have a friend whose daughter is a teacher in St. John's County, and they tell us that they are having issues in their schools. So I think we need to have a regional effort on this. St. John's, Clay, Baker, Nassau, all these counties need to have school mandates. And if you're not doing that, we are doing a great disservice to our children, and those children are going to get in. Here's something, and you know this, Melissa. You know, we think that, I'm talking about 19 children in the hospital who are infected, some who are still under investigation, but there are hundreds of children who are going to get infected. They may not get into the hospital, but they may have MISC 4 to 6 weeks down the road, and we are actually bracing for that. And also, even worse, the long-term complications of COVID, the COVID long. Many of these children are going to have that. I think we are being very short-sighted if you are not looking at the big picture. And frankly, I think we are hurting our children.
May on the South Side. Hi, May.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having the doctor here. I was really impressed with Ware County, Georgia, Waycross, who obviously did not take their political leanings in mind and closed schools entirely for 2 weeks because they have an exponential increase in COVID infections. Their hospital is overloaded, just like ours, and I don't understand at all the two-week delay. If you just look at simple math, looking at the exponential increase in COVID infections that are reported each day, I'm not quite getting how a mask mandate 2 weeks from now is going to work, although I very much appreciate the effort by all concerned to do something instead of nothing.
All right, May.
I'll take my comments off air.
Darryl Willey, what about that? There seems to be quite a bit of support for the move you and your colleagues made, along with some caveats, those who feel you could go even farther.
Yeah, I think there's always going to be folks who believe we can go farther. And like we said, we had some debate last night about pushing it sooner and to get it across the finish line as a majority. That's where we landed. And it's of course not perfect. It's always imperfect with the plan, but we believe it's going to put kids and our staff in a better place.
We're speaking with Duval County School Board Vice Chair Darryl Willey and pediatrician Dr. Mobeen Rathor about the school board's decision last night to join 7 other districts around the state in defying the governor and mandating masks for students. If you have a kid in the Duval County Public Schools, you must make sure they're masked now. If you want to opt them out, you must have a note from a pediatrician, a doctor, an MD, or a DO laying out a medical reason why they cannot wear a mask. A parent opt-out form will no longer work. You have until September 7th to do that. We'll go back to your calls in a moment, but in the meantime, lots of emails and tweets. Darryl Willey, here's a tweet for you from a teacher. He says masks get most of the coverage, but there are other things like robust or any contact tracing, modifying code reds, you know, the active shooter drills that schools do, postponing open house, taking care of exposed staff. I'm concerned these will fall through the cracks. What about some of these other concerns, like the active shooter drills, school open house, worries that contact tracing isn't robust enough in the schools, Daryl?
Yeah, those are great. Those are great questions. They're definitely not falling under by the wayside at all. We actually had extensive conversations with our Department of Health colleagues last night. They're expanding their staff, almost doubling their staff to help contact tracing. We're actually putting measures in place, especially for elementary school students, where they find out even sooner if there's a positive case in their classroom. You mentioned code red drills. We actually are putting in a waiver to the State Department of Education to get a waiver on that, because we believe that's an unsafe and really risky high point for students to be able to transmit.
Wait a minute. So you're asking the state to stop the active shooter drills for now?
Yeah, what we're doing is actually having a waiver. As they did last year, they had a waiver. And instead of actually doing the active shooter drill, you explain exactly what you're going to do during the drill, at least for now, because huddling folks in a corner of a classroom all together is just not the safest. So all those measures that we're talking about are just that. And we also have more testing in place. We're going to have more rapid testing for our staff to make sure that they can get tested more regularly and more frequently. So we're doing not just the mask. And as that caller or emailer mentioned, it's not just about the mask. It's about all the mitigation efforts put together. And that's what's going to get us over this hump that we're in right now.
Now, the other day when we spoke on our show, the Florida Roundup, with the U.S. Education Secretary Miguel Cardona, he expressed frustration that so much federal funding from the pandemic relief effort had been sent down to school districts, but he claimed the state hadn't doled enough of it out. Here's a tweet from Ann. Has the Duval County Public Schools received all of the federal funding for COVID mitigation from the state, or is the state still holding on to it? She asks.
We've received some, and we've planned out what we're going to do with all of our dollars, because they've sort of scheduled out what we have, but we haven't received all of our funding. And that's something, too, that's going to help with our mitigation efforts. Once we get those funds, we'll be able to do a lot with those CARES Act dollars.
Have you gotten an explanation from the state why you haven't gotten the money, all of the money?
No, we haven't. No, we haven't gotten an explanation from them, but we are pressing them for that. And it's bureaucratic. There's red tape there, but we hope to get those monies very soon.
On Facebook, Marty writes, Dr. Rathore is a true community hero. We owe him a debt of gratitude. Shame on the two school board members who place politics above science. Dr. Rathore, this has always been about science for you and the protection of children.
Yes, it has been. And although I appreciate the sentiment, it's not just me. There's many of us who are very active in advocating for children, and although I'm thankful for the sentiment, but this is not a job that it's a community effort, and I think we clearly showed yesterday that there were community people out there. You know, we as physicians, we feel the weight of this because we see these patients in the hospitals, we see the suffering, we see the children, we see the parents, the grandparents, and it's heartbreaking because we feel that this is preventable. I mean, most of these should not happen. So I think that's what really motivates us to make sure that we don't see those parents. And I can tell you, we have had patients and we have had parents who did not get immunized or immunize their children, and they regret that. I mean, they're really regretting that and feel like, and you've seen testimonies about that from various people. And this is a real thing. Once you get it, if you know somebody who's gotten it, you will know that it is not something to make light of. It is a serious, serious thing.
Kimberly in Jacksonville. Hello, Kimberly.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Hello. Well, thank you guys for having me on. I just wanted to extend my thanks to the school board, particularly Mr. Willie, and also the physicians who spoke last night at the meeting. I work as a mental health counselor in the public school system, and I do not feel safe without the mask mandate. I think that's really important. So I'm fully vaccinated. I wear my mask, and I think every little bit helps. So we just need to stand up and reject any of that nonsense. This is not a political issue. It's a health pandemic, and we have got to have common sense policies in place to get the Delta variant under control so that we can protect our communities and families. Even one person that's saved by this measure it's worth it. We've got to do this. It's common sense, and it's showing kindness and respect for our community and neighbors. So thank you guys for doing the right thing. And for the two that voted against, I think the community will remember those no votes in the upcoming election.
Thanks for everyone who's called. Thank you to Daryl Willey for joining after a late night. He's vice chair of the Duval County School Board. Daryl, thanks for your time. And thanks.
No, thank you.
Thank you. And thanks to pediatrician Dr. Mobeen Rathor, who's led on this consistently. Thank you, doctor.
Thank you very much. Keep up the good work, Melissa.
You as well. And much more still ahead later. How you can become a desk defender this week and join the superheroes fighting poverty in Jacksonville. That's later. But up next.
In the Duval County Courthouse, there is a mandate that everyone in the courthouse must wear a mask. There's also some screenings that are occurring when you walk into the courthouse. However, not everyone is complying with the mask mandate.
We'll tell you why local attorneys say courtrooms need either stronger rules or they want to go back to virtual court. That's after this. Criminal defense attorneys in North Florida are calling for a return to virtual court. They say it's because a mask mandate in courthouses in this judicial circuit isn't being consistently followed. Shannon Schott is a partner at Plata Schott Attorneys and Counselors at Law, and I spoke with her. So Shannon, tell us what's going on inside local courtrooms when it comes to mask mandates.
So in the Duval County Courthouse specifically, there is a mandate that everyone in the courthouse must wear a mask. There's also some screenings that are occurring when you walk into the courthouse. However, not everyone is complying with the mask mandate, or they're not properly wearing their mask, or they're waiting until the judge hits the bench for them to actually put on the mask. And then for the screening, the questions are just woefully inadequate and really being conducted by bailiffs who have no healthcare expertise.
And you and other local attorneys have asked Chief Judge Mark Mahan to, I guess, crack down on this situation, right?
Among other things, I think that's the most public-facing issue, is that when you come into the Duval County Courthouse right now, I don't feel secure, and I don't think the public would feel secure, but this is our courthouse. People come there for a number of reasons: to conduct business, to apply for wedding licenses, happy and unhappy reasons to come to court. And you should feel safe when you walk into the courtroom and the courthouse. And I just don't know if that's the sensation you're getting at this time.
What's the response been back from the chief judge? Because he did order everyone to start masking up again a few weeks ago when the Delta variant started spreading widely through the community.
He did, and as we stated in our correspondence, we appreciate that he is making an effort by ordering masks. However, the order has no teeth if it's not being enforced. We've seen no one in the courtroom or in the courthouse enforcing the order that's been entered, and it's really self-regulated right now, so the order doesn't really seem to have teeth. Furthermore, we have no idea what is going on in the judicial offices and what orders are being entered, because if you go into the courthouse, there's multiple traffic of pattern between inmates, the judiciary, employees, the public, the attorneys, but we're all having contact at some point. So what the public is seeing with the mask mandates, we have no idea what's happening behind closed doors, and we have no idea the extent to which courthouse employees and personnel are being screened. So while we appreciate the effort, there has to be an enforcement of these rules to keep everybody safe. Otherwise, there needs to be an effective alternative option. And what we have proposed is virtual court.
And what's the chances of that happening again? Because the court was being held virtually for some time.
It was. And in fact, it still is in some courtrooms. So domestic violence court, civil court appearances. Most every other practitioner is coming to court virtually, and work is being done effectively and efficiently. Unfortunately, it's the Fourth Circuit's position that the criminal defense and criminal attorneys, both state attorneys, public defenders, and private defense attorneys, need to be in the courtroom. There are rules that state that we can waive our clients' appearances. However, we're being told that our waivers are no longer valid or that they've expired, which is not accurate pursuant to the rules. And we simply can't understand why are we in particular, the criminal defense practitioners, need to be physically in the courtroom. We can get our job done effectively virtually. We can communicate virtually. We can appear for non-essential hearings virtually and continue to move the cases so that the cases that need to come in person, sentencing hearings, evidentiary hearings, and trials can be conducted in courtrooms where there are less people.
So what's the next move then for your organization?
Our statewide organization, FACTL, is now involved, and we are really just trying to educate the public about the effectiveness of virtual court. And once the courthouse determined that, you know, COVID's over and we can go back to pre-COVID protocols, I think the issue is that whether it's a pandemic, whether it's flu season, virtual court has longevity and perpetuity for its usefulness for our court system. Whether it's civil, criminal, or otherwise, the access to court has never been greater. And so we want our community members to ask their elected officials, the elected chief judge, and all of the elected judges, to seriously reconsider their position on not allowing everyone to appear virtually. If you are a criminal defendant in a minor traffic offense, you know, for you to have to leave work, leave your job, is just too much of a burden when you're not even facing jail time. You could lose your job. And if you had the option to appear virtually, you can show up on time, you can wait for your court case to be called, but you don't have to, you know, rush down to the courthouse. We're not packing people into the courthouse. So whether it's COVID or another pandemic, or simply just to have operations running smoother and you're not having a safety risk with hundreds and hundreds of people descending on the courthouse at any given time, it just makes sense financially for both judicial economy as well as economics, you know, cold hard cash. It makes so much sense to give people access to courts virtually, especially for criminal defendants, many of whom will never actually go to jail, who have minor offenses, so that their lives aren't more negatively impacted than what they're already going to experience being criminal defendants.
Well, keep us posted. Shannon Schott, partner at Plata Schott Attorneys and Counselors at Law. She and other defense attorneys around the state, and in particular in this circuit, want virtual court more widely used right now. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Melissa.
Well, the U.S. Senate recently passed a $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill. This will result in the skilled trades seeing a surge in job creation. President Biden's plan is anticipated to create millions of new jobs over the next decade, but who is going to fill them? Tulsa Welding School Jacksonville has a word to say about that. They are the oldest welding school in the country. Mike Cole is with Tulsa Welding School Jacks, and he's on the line. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Melissa. Thank you for having me this morning.
Good to have you. Okay, so the infrastructure plan is anticipated to transform this country and add a lot of jobs and bring us into the 21st century in terms of our infrastructure in many ways. How is this going to impact the future of the skilled trades industry?
Well, it's obviously going to create a bigger skills gap than what we saw, what we already knew was going to happen. And we're hopeful that we can help fill that. We know that there's already about 2.4 million skilled trades positions that are going to be unfilled before, through 2028. We also know that there's projected growth of jobs of about 704,000, and that was before the White House plan of about 2 million jobs per year coming over the next decade. So there are a lot of jobs that are going to be vacated and opened, and I think a lot of opportunities for people that want to work as well.
And certainly in this pandemic, people are starting to think about other jobs, other career paths, and they're looking at the skilled trades. Can you explain for folks, what are some of the occupations that you think will be most in demand?
I think you're going to see a lot of the skilled trades, particularly the welding, as it relates to infrastructure, welding, HVAC, solar, all of the things that we found out during the pandemic you have to have when everyone was looking for different ways to work and keep things going. You realize how important things like air conditioning can be, whether it's commercial, residential, or all of those things. I also think you're going to see some IT and some other essential work, such as healthcare, of course, continue to blossom. But I do think, particularly given what's happening now with this infrastructure bill, you're going to see the welding and the linemen and things of that nature for folks that are good at doing things with their hands. Those are going to be the things that continue to boom as we go forward.
And, you know, it's interesting how the conversation around this is changing. When I was in junior high and high school, there was a shop class, right? And then that went away. And I never understood that. Like, why would you junk those classes? Because not everybody in school plans to go to college. Schools like yours have filled the gap, right?
Yep. Yes, yes. Melissa, I will tell you, I've been doing trade school education for 23 years, and I meet with guidance counselors at local high schools. I've met with professionals. I influence and have talks with employers all the time, and I like to let guidance counselors in particular know, you know, four-year colleges are not for everybody. They weren't for one of my sons. My youngest son is a chef, and he parlayed that into becoming a teacher, a culinary teacher at the local high school that still has the program. So you're right. There are opportunities for people that aren't interested in going to school for four-year traditions, that like to work with their hands, that need to do things to provide for their families quickly, and they kind of have gone by the wayside. And what we did see through COVID, though, is enrollment numbers go up because a lot of those jobs that were eliminated due to the pandemic, these jobs stayed open. So coming back to the things that work with your hands, things that are necessary and needed, we did see a huge surge in those kind of things.
Yeah. And I do believe Duval County Schools has recently recommitted to vocational education, haven't they? There is a course path like that for kids in this district now. There didn't used to be, but there is again.
Yep. Some schools. Some of the local high schools have gone back to that for sure. And they don't all do the same things, but they have committed that to some extent, yes.
Okay. We're speaking right now with Mike Cole with the Tulsa Welding School Jacksonville about how the infrastructure bill, which will be in the trillions of dollars, will help the skilled trades industry. What are the biggest misconceptions about these jobs, would you say, Mike?
I think the biggest misconceptions about these jobs are people believe they're for students of lower caliber. That's not true, right? I get to meet students that are very smart academically, but quite honestly, they would rather go do something with their hands than read it in a book. These guys can do things that I can't. When I first arrived in Tulsa Welding, I was amazed and really taken aback by how much art and science is in this welding, and to see these guys do things that I can't do. I'm a pretty decent student, but I can't do what they do. And I think that there's really a misconception that people that work in skilled trades are less than those that are doing the academics. And like I said, I would almost welcome anyone to come in and try to step in the booth and do what these students do. It's not easy.
Sure. And as you said a moment ago, everything from updating the electrical grid to our highways to our public transit to solar capability is going to become so important. Let's talk about just that piece of it, solar installation and increasing renewable energy into the grid. That requires talent.
For sure. Talent and knowledge. Again, I would go back to the misconception. I think that there's a belief that because people are good with their hands, they don't understand a lot of the academic substances. The students have to know the math and the things that go into that as well. You get particularly with the renewable energy sources, as this becomes more prevalent and it's clear in the infrastructure bill that it will be, you're going to need people that understand the technology. And I think partially the reason why we've been reluctant to turn to renewable energy sources as a country is our lack of understanding. And one of the things that I get the benefit of watching is students learn more about it. And you can see once people understand it, they're excited to kind of get it involved and put it up in their homes and into businesses. And like I said, it's in the infrastructure bill. We can debate whether it's enough money or not, but there are going to be tons of jobs created through the emphasis on green positions, though.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about your institution. It's the oldest welding school in America, Tulsa Welding School. I guess it was founded in Tulsa, Oklahoma, but you have a chapter here in Jacksonville. I have to confess, when I think of welding, I picture Jennifer Beals in Flashdance. that's kind of my image of a welder, which is that gives you an idea of when I was in high school. Okay, but tell us how the education program works at your school.
So a student comes in and it's a short-term program. They can do the welding program in and of itself, or we also do the electrical program and HVAC programs in about a seven, eight-month time. It's the majority of the program is hands-on. We tell you how to do it, but then we let you get into the lab and actually do it, and we train you as you go through and go through all of the steps. For example, in the welding, our students are trained to do pipe welding. They're trained to do TIG. They're trained to do MIG. Anything that they're going to do into the field, that we do. The other thing that we make sure that we do a lot of is invite employers into our school to talk about what it is that our students need to do. So if we've got companies that have special weld projects, we can teach that too. One of the things that I'm most proud of is, in addition to the hard skills, the hands-on skills, we teach a lot of the soft skills, and we teach the discipline of showing up every day. Our students aren't allowed to miss a whole lot of days here, so we get them used to having to show up, be dependable, be reliable, all of those things that as employers that we think are important. But most importantly, we do a great job of having employers on campus to do interviews and hire our students directly. So it works well that our students not only come here for an education, but they get a very good opportunity to show off and showcase their skills to employers while they're here as well.
Check them out, the Tulsa Welding School, Jacksonville. Mike Cole on the line. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Melissa. I appreciate your time this morning.
And in a moment.
We provide emergency financial assistance, groceries, clothing, and case management to families in emergency situations.
How you can help local families struggling in our area by becoming a desk defender. We'll explain next.
I'm Marco Werman. We're living through history, and the world's newsroom has the first draft.
We are working on providing assistance to people in need, and we want to show people in Afghanistan that we have not abandoned them.
Looking for answers and making sense of global events as they happen. Join us on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. Kenya's Eliud Kipchoge is arguably the best marathoner to ever live, the only person to run 26.2 miles in less than 2 hours.
I ran because I love the sport. Running is what actually has made me to enjoy life. You know, I always say where freedom is only in running.
A runner and his philosophy next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, a dark side of the Navy SEALs. We talk with David Phillips, whose new book is about Eddie Gallagher, the SEAL who led his platoon in driving ISIS out of Mosul, was later tried for war crimes and granted clemency by President Trump. It's also about the SEALs who turned Gallagher in. Phillips covers the military for the New York Times. I hope you'll join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
President Biden says evacuations from Afghanistan could continue beyond the end of the month. But for most of the country's 14 million women, there's no plane waiting to get them out.
In 19 years, I'm studying and I'm striving to achieve my goals. But today, unfortunately, all my dreams died.
What does Taliban rule mean for women and girls in Afghanistan? We ask them next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, the Downtown Ecumenical Services Council is hosting an event this week to help local families in poverty. And I'm honored to be emceeing this virtual evening from right here at WJCT Studios. You can watch right from home and become a superhero in the effort to help out. A desk defender, as they're called. I spoke with Executive Director David Clark. So let's talk about desk defenders against all odds and how people can be part of this, David.
Yes, it's a great fundraiser. And so we've got a couple of different ways to be part of it. And we have some fundraising teams that are working right now at deskdefenders.com. And it's a great way to support folks who are out there raising money to help our cause. But the way that everyone can participate is to watch our Facebook Live event on Thursday, August 26th at 6 p.m.
I am really looking forward to emceeing this with you. People can check it out right on your Facebook page. This is a way to help families that are struggling in this city right now. Let's explain what Downtown Ecumenical Services Council, or DESC, does for this community.
Absolutely. Well, I'm looking forward to emceeing with you as well. So we provide emergency financial assistance, groceries, clothing, and case management to families in emergency situations.
And right now, more than ever, David, this is so critical, what the work Absolutely. Of DESC means for the 904. Tell us what you're seeing, the needs in the community right now.
Absolutely. You're right. It is more critical than ever. The pandemic has really created a lot of different challenges for folks, and I think some people have been able to get through it just fine. But for those folks who are living in poverty or who have been on the edge of poverty, it's been a real challenge for them. It's pushed some farther into the economic challenges than others. It has made them experience things they've never experienced before, like food insecurity, having the power shut off, being evicted from their homes. And the statistics and the predictions of the chaos that will happen once the eviction moratorium ends is really quite startling. So, keeping people in their homes, keeping people with their power, making sure they have food and clothes, or all those basic needs, those are the things that we have to work on as a community.
Now, with the celebration that people can be part of virtually, it's framed as almost like being part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Mm-hmm. You're calling superheroes to become desk defenders. Let's talk about that.
Absolutely. So everyone has within themselves the opportunity to be a superhero. That's our concept, because it's really true. You know, the human spirit is very generous. It's a very caring, innate sense in all of us. It's the way we are. And as Americans, we've been wonderful at philanthropy forever. And since we were started, and so many years ago. And so I think that this is a chance for us to embrace and encourage and celebrate that spirit within. We created these superheroes to represent our services. We've got Captain Underwear and Princess Pantaloons to represent clothing. And we have Commander Current, who represents our financial assistance program of keeping people in their homes and the utilities on. And then we have Queen Appetite, who represents the food and security.
It's so cute. And it's a catchy way to get people excited about the mission of DESC, the Downtown Ecumenical Services Council. Now, this is a faith-based organization, but it's not tied to any particular segment of the community, right? You serve everyone.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So our origins are in the downtown churches coming together. And so we are definitely faith-based, and we are very proud of our religious background and our ministries, because we really consider it to be ministries. But of course, our effort is to reach out to all people where they are in their walk, and their faith is not a criteria that matters to us. We just want to make sure we're there to help them in their journey and help them with their basic needs, so they can have what they need to take care of themselves and their families.
That's right. So with that said, we ask everyone to join us 6 o'clock Thursday, August 26th for a live celebration. It's DESC Defenders Against All Odds. I'll be emceeing along with you, David Clark, and people need to watch on your Facebook page and help families fight poverty in this community and donate what they can.
Absolutely. It's going to be fun.
Again, join us Thursday night for that virtually. And thanks for listening. Thanks also to senior producer Heather Schatz, director Isabella Da Silva, associate producer Catherine Hobbs, along with editorial director Jessica Palumbo and digital editor Bill Bortsfield. Drop us a line. We love your feedback. Emails go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Our podcast is up later today on all platforms, including the WJCT app. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks so much for being with us here on First Coast Connect. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Remember, the Pfizer vaccine now has full FDA approval. No excuses, people. Go get the vaccine, and please keep wearing your mask.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.